through we will have all got a sense of bringing some threads together from our previous work, which I think will help us as we go on. Had we finished with implementation, compliance, enforcement? I think we probably had got as far as we were usefully going to get on that. So I'd propose to go into use and use cases and case studies. Does anybody want to take the floor on this issue and think about what we would be covering under it? Peter?
Just preliminarily, I guess I had seen this section, if I understood correctly how we would use it, it would be a stepping stone between the sort of background type sections where we've got the policy and the implementation and so on, and a stepping stone to our gap analysis. In my view, it would be useful to pick case studies that step through to where we want to end up. So, a number of case studies that didn't lead us anywhere, I'm not sure how useful they would be. So I think if we think through where we want to end up and then we think of a case study which helps us to move through to there. One that I was writing down from our discussion earlier this morning where we've got a potential expectation reality issue is that resellers should be looked after by registrars or somehow, but in practice potentially may not be. It may be useful to have a use study there which can lead to a potential gap. This is just thinking through. We've got we've certainly identified questions around proxy and privacy services, so it may be useful to have a use study or a case study around that issue. It would, I think, given our scope, certainly be useful to have one around a law enforcement type example. Now, whether they're linked to one of those previous two, I'm not sure. But and the other one, Lynn may be able to help more here, or someone else. This is not an area I've delved into very much, but a case study around the use of WHOIS for the dispute resolution providers. That's just some suggestions to get the ball rolling.
Thank you, Peter. Because James,
Not going to necessarily. No. I just wanted to perhaps just take an opposing view, just as a thought experiment. Whether or not I'm not, dead set against what Peter's proposing, I just wanted to think through the contrary case, which is that when we start to enumerate case studies or use cases, we have to be comprehensive and we have to get them all. And my concern is that we are bound to leave something out, and that something shortly after the publication of our report and recommendations, in between that and the next 3-year review, some new case study or use case will arise. And so I guess my concern is that when we get detailed and prescriptive like that, we have to be then exhaustive. And if we are not, we leave gaps, we leave loopholes, and we really kind of doom the next iteration of this review. So, it's just a thought that if we can keep things abstract, then we can be flexible to deal with those things as they arise, either immediately or in the next review cycle. And I think that might be more informative to the policymaking arms of ICANN. So, again, not married to this position, just thinking it through on the other side. Thanks.
I've got Sharon who wants to come in, and then Peter.
Yeah, I tend to support James, actually, because I think if you, for example, I just focus on the law enforcement, there would be a tendency to dive straight into one where it's all gone horribly wrong, and you know, because of who is not being accurate, the investigation, we had to go elsewhere. And that's not a complete picture, actually. And I think you're right, there's a danger of not giving an accurate picture. And I, in our previous bit of work, we were talking about the stakeholders and the legitimate use of who is for all those stakeholders. I think that paints enough picture of what people expect from it. We could have some annexes if people specifically wanted to know examples of when it worked and didn't work, but I think that we would be in danger of leaving stuff out and it wouldn't be a whole picture.
Peter and then Bill.
I'm agreeing with what James and Sharon have said, but so is the suggestion, just to be clear though, that we don't have a section on case studies, that we go from the sort of backgroundy stuff where we lay out the policies and the implementation, and then we move to a gap analysis, building in comments that we receive from stakeholders and so on, but we don't necessarily dive into a deep dive on a case study. Just to be clear.
So I would suggest that yes, we would skip this, and instead, in our section where we're identifying stakeholders, we identify the stakeholder and then their stake, and then let in the feedback and the outreach, let them give us their use cases, and then so it's not something that kind of came from this group, but it was something that this group collected, and that way we're not necessarily on the hook for getting them all. It's just a thought.
Bill and then Lynn.
So at the risk of agreeing, I agree.
Well, it is after lunch. So.
Yeah, I'm satisfied that the stakeholders is going to be useful, and that it makes this section actually somewhat redundant. So I'm satisfied with the stakeholder section.
I think that we all seem to be thinking the same way, which is, I hadn't really you made me understand this earlier, that the whole idea of use cases actually came from an idea of Lutz when we were talking about different stakeholders, and I hadn't understood it in that way, and that what in fact it's part of is, what are the stakeholders, how do they use who is, what are they expecting and stuff. And so I think that, so shall we just delete this section and ensure that in our bit about stakeholders we have how are they using the who is and what are they expecting?
Wow. Yeah, this is Bill. I think that's a good idea, and we don't have to be in doing that. They are examples of how, and we aren't saying this is the definitive list, and we don't need to be complete. We can show, you know, used in this way, used in this way. And as James said, we can let people comment, come back, and see if we've missed big things. But I'm concerned that if we have a section like this, that we absolutely, there's no way to be complete. Same thing that we had on applicable laws, really. Right? We can't define everything.
So the one thing that comes to mind that may belong here is just a simple reference to the studies that the who is studies that have been done, because hopefully everybody that is going to be so interested in reading this report, they may not have followed what else ICANN has done, and there is a case study where they evaluated domain registrations, and we came up, there is a statistic out there on inaccuracy. So maybe a simple link and a reference to that. And there may be other case studies that, you know, I'm just not thinking of right now.
Yeah, I'm okay if we have a basically list the studies that have been done.
Perhaps under the background section or something earlier on.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of trying to figure out how all of the ways that it can be used or can't be used, I very much agree with James and others that
okay.
we just can't do a good job of it, no matter how hard we try.
Okay, so thank you. Did you want to come in, Lynn?
There's another point that I don't think we've captured, and it's not really use cases, but perhaps it fits under implementation, and I don't think we've talked about it, and it's the ease of use or the difficulty of use in looking up Whois data. And for those of us who've had to look up Whois data, it's not straightforward, and I don't think the average person can really look up Whois data very easily. So I think it needs to be addressed somehow. I have, in my own mind, thought about either a flowchart or a table, but I think we need to capture that somewhere in this report.
Perhaps if I can suggest that we put that in the gap analysis, because if we go back to what we understand the policy to be, there is a thing about availability, and part and parcel of availability is that people actually know where to find the information. So perhaps that's where we could capture that idea.
You know, really, you shouldn't have to be a detective to look it up and to go from one place to another. And some of the registries, you actually have to log in. You have to go through a CAPTCHA, only to find that it's a thin Whois, and then you've got to, and it's only going to give you the registrar information. Then you've got to go to that registrar. Then you've got to look that up. So it's not easy. Yes, and then then you run into a proxy, or you run into something that is blatantly fictitious. Yeah.
Okay, so if we can just scroll back up, Alice, I think that we're all comfortable taking out the use cases and case studies and just deleting that. And then if you go back up to our little highlighted section on stakeholder analysis, if you just pop at, oh yeah, we've got that there anyway, use cases. So if you just add onto use cases how stakeholders, different stakeholders use Whois and what their expectations might be or something like that. So we've just got the placeholder there. So then I think we're quite comfortable down to the gap analysis. We can do this now, or would it help to have a bit of the presentation on implementation to feed the ideas, or do we feel comfortable that we can just do a bit of a brainstorm on this? I think we probably know what the gaps are to a sufficient degree to just throw some ideas out now, and that will take Salmed's point. Yeah.
Perhaps the first gap is there is no Whois policy, in a sense, right? It isn't defined in a single place. And
so, Alice, can you? So, I think we'll keep that there, mm-hmm. the text that we have, and can you just do another subheading, a bit like you did with the stakeholder things, and just go put gaps. And just put maybe put the date or something like that, so that we know when we did this work, and then just throw out that. I think everybody would be in agreement to that.
If I could suggest a phrasing there, I would call it the lack of a formal document, or of a formal single document.
Yeah, that's fine.
It doesn't mean there's no policy. It just means we're lacking a formal document. Yeah.
Sorry, I think we already kind of answered this when we said earlier. We said comprehensive, centralized, and authoritative. I don't even remember the adjectives, but there was a chain of them that we kind of worked up some language on, and we can probably reiterate that here. There is no
or a lack of, or there is an absence, you know, something like that.
I agree with James verbatim. I think just the way he said it would be perfect. No, it is written down somewhere, but that would be good to say. You know, basically what you were trying to get out. There isn't one place to go.
Centralized.
It's not da 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 da. Yeah. And
Peter.
Just, I think I mentioned this at one of our previous meetings, but for those of us who don't follow all the other little parts of ICANN, of interest, the CCNSO has faced a similar issue to us, I guess, in that they also lack a single definitive source of policy for delegation and redelegation of CCTLDs. And one thing that they have decided, they've formed what they're calling a framework of interpretation working group. So I think at this stage they're not necessarily looking at changing policy, but they're looking to put together a document that helps people to understand what the policy is and the linkages between it and so on. So they're looking at keywords in the policy and if there are any differences between the keywords and key phrases across the different documents where that policy is spread and so on. So I think that may be something useful for this review team to keep in mind. Like, we're not alone in having this problem, and a different part of the community is looking at a potential solution to this.
It's part of the oral tradition, I think, that it doesn't mean there isn't a policy. It just means it's difficult for a newcomer to find it. So, Alice, are you comfortable that we've captured that thought? Uh-huh. Lack of centralized, authoritative, comprehensive policy document.
Single source.
Single source. Are there any other policy type gaps? No regulator.
Well.
Okay.
Specifically, I suggest there's a gap between what the AOC indicates is policy and what the implementation, the contracts, specify.
Do we... should we take those in turn? Michael suggested no regulator as a gap. Does anybody have any thoughts, responses?
Michael, could you just explain further what you mean by regulator?
I refer to the segmentation of different stakeholders, which we did previously. And it was found out that we should somehow define or locate an entity which is responsible for the implementation of the policy and the supervision of what happens here. So to my mind, there is no such visible regulator, no such body, and the open question is whether we should treat it as a gap, as an issue, or we should not.
I have James. Peter, do you want to James first?
I was going to address Bill's question, so I'll pass.
Anyone on regulator? Peter, Bill.
Just have a question. Is ICANN not the regulator? Just to help me out here, in what sense is it not, given that it has contracts which it should be enforcing, and it's ICANN's policies? So to what extent is ICANN not the regulator?
I would rather call ICANN the environment, not the regulator itself. Who within ICANN can be treated as such a regulator? Which entity, which person, which position, which who is there? Yeah.
Bill?
Well, I do not insist, I'm asking.
Yeah.
So I think Michael asks a good question. And it's something I see a lot at ICANN, actually, the sort of where I'm coming from on this. ICANN is at least three things in my mind. There is ICANN, the community, right? We're all part of the community. There's ICANN, the staff, and ICANN, the corporate entity. And I think we need to be specific when we're talking about different things. So from my perspective, ICANN, the corporate entity, may in fact be the regulator here. They have the responsibility to ensure compliance and to enforce. So that's very much a regulator. ICANN, the community, is supposed to establish the policy that the board then, the corporation then says, yes, that's really it. So I tend to agree with Peter that ICANN, the corp, is in fact the regulator. And that, you know, the other, we just need to be cautious when we're talking about things.
Thank you. James?
So I've always been very careful not to use the R word when referring to ICANN, and we sometimes refer to it as that. But I would submit that if we were looking at something that has the force of law, which usually is encompassed in the definition of a regulator, then now we're looking at the Department of Commerce and the NTIA, which has delegated quite a bit of its authority or responsibilities to ICANN via the AOC and the IANA contract. But that, to me, at least my granted clumsy understanding of the word regulator, that's where the regulation lives. Because that could, through force of law, for example, change at that point, not through ICANN. So by the way, been trying to explain the three different faces of ICANN to other folks in other contexts, so thank you for getting that clearly on the record. I couldn't agree more that there's a lot of confusion, especially when somebody says we're signing a contract with ICANN and folks in the community think, well, that means us, and the answer is, well, no, you can't sign a contract with a community, you know. But anyway, so going to the question of no regulator, I think there is a regulator. At that level, it's then delegated to this international, what's called, I believe, a technical and policy coordinating body that this animal that we all participate in that has all these three functions that Bill enumerated.
It's an interesting question, though, isn't it? Because I think it does highlight a bigger point, which is something about empowerment and legitimacy. You know, that for folks who come from an environment where self-regulation is a bit of a norm or has been, then there's no conceptual difficulty with the idea of a corporation being a regulator. But there is something that's different about a corporation towards a government type of body or something that is, you know, and it goes to legitimacy and empowerment. You know what? And one of the things that I think struck me, and I'm speaking here as a sort of participant in the group, about speaking when we had our session with the compliance team in London, was the sense of lack of empowerment that they had. Oh, we can't really do anything about this. We can't really do anything about that. Now, I'm not sure whether it's my ignorance, but I don't know whether you would hear a government-style regulator saying that sort of stuff. But maybe that's just me. Did anybody? Okay.
Yeah, but I think of this more as accountability, because in the corporate world, I've been an information security officer and I've been a chief privacy officer, and that's how I thought about those responsibilities. It's in the context of self-regulation that you have a person who is authorized to be accountable, and that accountability carries with it the authority
to enforce it, to enforce the policy. So, you know, perhaps the gap is that there's no clear accountability in ICANN. Who's really accountable if this policy is not carried out well? Who does it reflect on? You know, whose toes are in the fire? I don't think there is anybody.
After Bill.
So I'll just keep this free-flowing discussion going. But if my understanding was that if one of ICANN's contracted parties breached a contract, the responsibility would be for ICANN to take an action, and presumably again for a breach of policy. And then if ICANN didn't do that, ICANN may be accountable to the Department of Commerce. So in the first instance, to my mind, whether the regulator is the right word, but the entity responsible for contractual compliance and policy adherence, whatever the right word is there, is ICANN. And I assume this is what ICANN compliance staff do. Now, the then question is that I agree that ICANN compliance staff, we've heard, say they don't have power here in some cases and they can't enforce and so on. But my understanding was that's not so much a question of not having the authority. It's that the contractual tools that they have been given aren't particularly clear or able to be enforced. And from a government perspective, that's not that uncommon for governments. Like, governments try to make laws where they've got a clear head of power from their constitution or what have you. But when it comes down to taking these things to a court, it's entirely possible that public servants like me have not written the legislation or what have you, or the contracts in the best way, and it proves that they are difficult to enforce. It's not a question that you don't have the power, you just may not have put it together appropriately. So I'd be potentially interested in hearing back from compliance staff where they think they've got a difficulty enforcing things is because of the tools they have, or an actual concern about their authority to be in this space in the first place. I think I'd understood it to be the first of those. So that's just my thinking there.
Kim?
I agree with Michael that there is a lack of regulator. However we define that term, and I don't think actually that ICANN would be the necessarily, at least the way it's currently structured, actually appropriately called regulator, since it's just completely based on contractual obligations and based on at least what the compliance team told us, as Peter pointed out, in London, they don't seem to have, or they feel that they don't actually have the tools in place to enforce their policies. And any kind of regulatory body anyway comes with, I mean, you're only as good as your enforcement tools are, and any policy is only as good as far as it is actually enforceable. And so far I don't think that ICANN has shown, and actually matter of fact is they don't actually really do have, contractually speaking anyway, the tools to do so, and they don't have the support from the community, as James clearly pointed out. He doesn't like to use the R word, and rather be called the coordinators as opposed to a regulator. So, you know, I mean, there really is no significant support from the community in general for ICANN to actually take on that particular role. So I think there is really no justification right now to call them a regulator. In whatever fashion, however, you know, Bill defined them in whatever those three particular definitions.
Thank you. Bill, and then Susan.
Okay. So it's hearing the discussion, I've got a number of things going through my mind. Emily asked a question, would government have the same problem sort of with a regulator, and would they know? In the U.S., I would say generally, at least the regulators I have dealt with, by and large, they know what is within their purview and what isn't. There are questionable areas. I think one's going on right now at the FCC, but the FTC, the FCC, and some of the other organizations, they've been given pretty clear guidelines, you know, areas to operate within, and legislative authority. And that, I think, for me, gets to Lynn's point, the authority. Right? In a governmental sense, the authority is that there is a law or a set of laws, and a regulatory body is directed to do something. So the attempt is to be clear. Peter, as Peter indicated, it may not always be clear, but that's the attempt. The gap I'm seeing, or a gap I'm seeing, is this isn't clear. Right? Whether there is an official regulatory body or not, it's the fact that we can't identify who it might be. And I would throw out, actually, this team might in fact be the regulator, right? In a sense. We're not sitting by all the time regulating, but our job is to go and look and say, here's the law, here's the policy, here's the implementation. Are there gaps? Yes, no. And we make recommendations. Regulators, you know, government regulators have more power than that, but they are performing some of those same tasks, right? Here's what you're supposed to do, here's what you're doing, and we're calling you to task. So I think we could be seen as the regulator. I agree with the comments in the conversations we had with the compliance staff. They don't think they have the tools. They don't think they have the authority. The other thing that has become pretty clear to me, I sense actually fear when I talk to them. I think they're afraid to talk to us. I think they're afraid to act. And that's a concern for me. Right? If these people are in fact charged with attempting to do enforcement and other things, and I don't know the source of it, all right, but the number of times we have sat down with them and tried to tease out information, and our attempts to have meetings with them, just, you know, my senses are on high alert around this. And I believe they need to be given clear authority to enforce the contracts and to develop tools and do the things they need to do. I'm not suggesting, you know, they go overboard or whatever, but it's almost like, you know, we hear a lot, oh, we can't go there, we can't go here. And that's not what you would see out of, you know, a normal regulatory body. They'd be aggressive frequently if they see issues. So,
I've got Susan coming in. Can I just ask a question since we're coming out with various elephants in the room here? In other people's experience, how often is a regulator funded by its regulatees?
So,
Yeah, I can think of a few.
Yeah.
And complaints dispute resolution companies like ombudsman in industry ombudsman are often funded by the people that they're investigating complaints on, and in industry self regulation, the body is often. Yeah.
Okay, so I can't answer that question at all, but and at some points I'm agreeing with what's been said. I don't think that ICANN has the tools, but I also do not think that they have the clarity in the policy that they need. And then also I think they run into situations that were never predicted within that policy. And I have recently had issues in my own day-to-day work that required ICANN compliance. They both issues were around surrounded UDRPs. And there seemed to be sort of an all or nothing enforcement. It was, you know, it seemed like someone could rationally look at the issue at hand and go through and go, well, this makes no sense at all. Yes, we should transfer this domain name, but it resulted in a notification of breach to the registrar. And, you know, as they sort of laid it out for me, I'm like, whoa, do we really want to do that? I don't want to take somebody's business away from them. I just want my domain name, which I have won in a UDRP action. And then the other was surrounding a UDRP again, but it was definitely, there's no clarity depending on who you talk to, how you read the policy on different parts of the requirements of a UDRP. So, you know, just taking that and assuming that they're running into the same issues with who is policy. So that it's back to our, you know, first recommendation is let's create, not us create, but let's have a one central sourced authoritative document. So, and I think when we talk to the compliance group today, we might get some more input from them on this.
Yes, thank you. I'm trying to remember a couple of the things that wanted to, but I did want to just mention something to Bill's comment about the fear or the apprehension or the tension when dealing with compliance and really just, you know, staff in general, present company excluded. It was much worse, I think, in the previous review team that I was involved in. So now it's downright warm and friendly by comparison. But I don't know what the source of that is. I would also be curious of that as well. I think that there's a, I suspect that there are concerns that that any answer given is always the wrong answer to somebody. And that since they're beholden to so many masters, they just would rather say nothing. You know, that's my suspicion. But Olaf's laughing. I'm going to take that as I'm getting real warm. So, okay. Oh, funny. Okay. So, but going back to this concept of a regulator and where that ability, we've got a couple lawyers, we've got more than a handful of lawyers in the room. So I'm going to ask for some help with this legal theory concept, but if a giant corporation decided it wanted to leave a bunch of toxic waste in my yard, okay, for no reason except they just felt like that was a good thing to do, and I called the EPA and they said we're not going to do anything about it, I can take both of them to court, okay, because under the force of law I have rights. I'm drawing a contrast between, let's say, if I, as a registrant, am angry about what ICANN and VeriSign have done, or what ICANN and GoDaddy have done, I don't necessarily have rights under their contract. In fact, I think it explicitly says I do not have rights in that agreement. So I think there's an important distinction where someone has, when you talk about regulation, force of law, and consumer trust, consumer advocacy, there's an important distinction there between what it means in practical terms for people who are not a party to those contracts. But is that a correct or even a close interpretation of the...
Well, I think it's the themes that are coming out from the various interventions that we made, and we are having quite a free-flowing discussion, but I think it's important. It sparked from Michael's comment that there was no regulator, which made several other people in the room go, oh yes, there is. But I think that the whatever language we use, what we're describing is that in this situation there are things like authority, accountability, which is I think behind what you just said, James, about if somebody doesn't, and you said it in your original intervention, if somebody doesn't do something that they're supposed to do here, so what? what can anyone do about it? And I think that that might be the source of some of the frustrations that we see bubbling up from the community. And Kim's point about the regulator having to have the support of the community, you know, and the various self-regulatory environments that, that other people were talking about, that the industry itself has decided to place, you know, to place some authority in some third-party hands to a limited extent usually, but to fund it. So I think that there are things that we can capture here, that gaps that we're sensing, even if we can't quite develop it at this stage. I think that concepts like authority, accountability, community support for enforcement might well, could we pop them up there? I think those are coming through in what we're saying. Kim, Peter, and Lynn. Sorry, Lynn, you were in the queue. Let's go to Lynn first and then...
Yeah, just to follow those thoughts on and thinking about a lack of a regulator and the lack of clear accountability, it seems that people who've worked in the domain business for any length of time have a sense of who the bad actors are, that it's not a secret. And, you know, but for some reason, these bad actors aren't dealt with. And the bad actors aren't here on our review team, you know, and they're not participating in the consensus-based model. And maybe it comes back to the thing that nobody has that clear role and responsibility to go after them. I don't know, but I just think that this is... part of it is that somehow the bad actors aren't dealt with, and there is at least some sense of people in this industry of who they are.
So, Mike, do you want to come in just on that point? Because I've got a queue of Kim, Peter. So Susan wants to come in just on that.
I'm not sure I can realize who those bad actors are. They don't live and breathe the domain registrations. They don't live and breathe. I mean, how many WHOIS records does a compliance person look up, for example? How much in-depth research do they do? They look, they will review a specific issue if you bring it to them, but their job is not to, I mean, and maybe these are some of the questions we should ask them today, this afternoon. But I think Stacy really stated that pretty clearly in London was, we need your help. We need you to bring this to us. To identify them. And when they are, there is an outcry and there is there was a registrar from Estonia a few years back when it was, somebody realized he was, you know, had been to jail for fraud. And they did act once they had the information. But I just don't think that they see it in the ways that some people on this group have to live and breathe it every day.
Thank you. Kim, then Peter.
Oh, I just wanted to quickly respond to James and just confirm that that is correct, privy of contract. You're right about that. But at the same time, I think ICANN is at least in a different position, I would argue anyway, if I ever was to take to court. And I would certainly claim that they have some trust and fiduciary duty relationship. And as such, you can actually possibly try to sue them based on contractual obligations, even if you're not party to it.
When we were in Cartagena, the Ninth Circuit in California, which is the circuit that ICANN is in, I think issued a ruling that was the exact opposite of what you just said, though, unfortunately. Or fortunately. I don't know. Depends on how you look at it, I guess. But it was just interesting, let's say.
Actually, I don't want to get into a legal jurisprudence discussion here, but I'm just wanting to say
that. Good, because I am not equipped to have
it. Certainly, you know, I mean, matter of fact, they may very well go to appeal or whatever else, but at least I would argue that ICANN certainly has some fiduciary duty. And I can just talk about, obviously, from a Canadian perspective, and I definitely think that, for example, CIRA certainly would be subject to some kind of fiduciary duty obligations, which are certainly much higher standards than just the regular contractual relationships.
Okay, thank you. Peter, then Bill.
I think what I've said has been just discussed here. I was going to follow up James's point and say, I think this is something we should be looking at in terms of the no regulator question. If it's true that ICANN isn't responsible for the behaviour of its contracted parties, I'm really quite intrigued by this, and this could be a key question. It goes to what Susan said as well. Like if ICANN staff are waiting to be prompted and given names and so on before they'll do something, that's a particular regulatory model, not a very active one, I guess. Which goes to my point of the difference between compliance and enforcement before. There are certain things that people can do proactively in terms of education, awareness raising, audits, all kinds of things where a regulator can try to put themselves on the front foot. And then there is reactive stuff where you're waiting to be told of a particular very bad actor, and it still seems we may have a question about whether they can act, and if they don't act, if they are responsible for not acting. I guess I've started from the simple assumption that perhaps they were, so I'm getting more and more intrigued as this conversation goes on, particularly this judgment saying that potentially they were not responsible.
Sure. So on the, I agree, this is an interesting discussion around the, I think it's, and I am not a lawyer, it's around the whether the liability of ICANN and the other actors, contracted parties, to, in fact, do what they say they're going to do in their contracts. If that cannot be, if a third party can't bring a complaint about that, let's say under the U.S. judicial system, and therefore there's no way to do it, I think this is a gap, potentially, because as a registrant, I rely on those contracts, the promises made within them, and in order to conduct my business, I make assumptions about how these parties are going to interact. So if it turns out we can't bring actions that way, then we perhaps need a body within this ICANN, the organization, right, to bring such issues, perhaps. Susan's point about, it's a factual statement that staff said they needed our help, and they didn't have that information. And this is my statement. Next statement is not against staff. It's about ICANN, the corporation. If they need us to tell them who the bad actors are, then ICANN, the corporation, hasn't been doing its job for 10 years or more. They are the place, the collection point for all of these, or for many of these complaints. They know better than anyone. They have more data than anyone, potentially. Yes, we could help them, right? We individually could, PayPal as an example, eBay. We have lots of information about these, who we think are bad actors. We may be able to provide it to them. We may not, based on some certain interpretations of privacy law.
I know WIPO knows who the bad actors are.
Sure.
And you could go to the WIPO website and just look at the statistics and the cases there, and you can see patterns.
Yeah, but to me, this then is an example of ICANN, the corporation, not taking the action that we expect it to. Right. At PayPal, right? We look at malevolent behavior. We look for criminal activity. We have large numbers of people that do this. And if nothing is being done on the domain name system front to try and go after the bad actors, at ICANN, I don't know where it's happening except in private industry and a bit in law enforcement. And we can't do it on our own. And ICANN has the, they are the place, basically, where most of this stuff is coming together. They have the information, or should.
Just to help Alice record some of the elements of this discussion, with no regulator, can we put a dash? And I think if we put the words authority, accountability, support from the community, information about bad actors, can we also put, this is your point, Peter, a sort of strategy, it's about a reactive or proactive enforcement strategy. You know, we don't know. Having a strategy. Strategy, reactive or proactive. But there's also, it came out in what you were talking about obliquely, but it comes back to our presentation on implementation, is resources. It's a sense of organisational priority for this, and what flows from that is resources, adequate resourcing. And so I think that this might well be a gap that we have highlighted. I just wanted to state it. Yeah, and
in the resource, I mean, the people that we employ to do these, you know, the e-crime people we employ, they're not contract compliance staff. They're people who, you know, Lynn described what you have to do in order to get through who is. These are people who have, you know, are highly technical, and can track down this stuff, and, you know, it's difficult. And I'm not aware that ICANN has staff like that. Perhaps they do, but I'm not aware of it. And these investigations that we do, you know, are time-consuming, but we end up providing to law enforcement, you know, basically, here's a case.
Kim, does anybody else want to join the queue? James? Susan?
I'll join the queue.
Okay.
Just quickly going back to James' point, and following up on the terminology of bad actor, we just have to be clear that there is a distinction between the different bad actors that ICANN has direct enforceability rights versus others. For example, PayPal's and the bad actors that you're referring to are quite different from what I think James is probably referring to, as opposed to which would be rogue registrars and resellers, as opposed to, in your particular instance, we're probably just talking about the registrants and domainers and those kind of, or what we used to call squatters, and those kind of people.
Yeah, maybe I could just clarify that, you know, it seems that people who want to engage in malicious activity on the internet know which registrars, if you will, are lax or are not going to be diligent in who is data, and that they can procure domain names without providing any who is data. I mean, so that's why I say there's patterns, and the patterns reflect on registrars. They're not necessarily the people who carry out the malicious activity, but they're enabling it. And it comes back to lack of adherence to the who is policy.
Yeah, I've got James, then Susan, then Peter.
Thanks, James speaking. So I'm just trying to, I mean, this has been a good discussion, and I think it's funny how Michael gave two words. No regulator, and now we've written a whole new book with some sort of international legal theory and some really amazing stuff going on. But
Tolstoy.
Yeah. But I have to wonder now, as someone who has thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, just because it was very interesting, but I have to wonder what the practical implications for what we're doing are. Okay? And it's, you know, I think that we could say here's a gap, and we could then make a recommendation, but, I mean, we should probably know right now it's going nowhere.
as far as the chain of authority of ICANN from NTIA and the Department of Commerce. I mean, that those arguments are much bigger than what's going on in this review, I think. So I guess my question is, what is the immediate and practical impact on WHOIS that we have this lack of clarity, I guess, on the role of a regulation or regulator, and what can we do about it, and what's the likelihood that does it even incumbent upon us to try and fix that or to even note on that? So, but just putting that on the table.
Thank you, James, and I think that's I can see already hands up to think about that, and maybe the point where we fold that in is under our recommendations, so what can we usefully recommend in the context of WHOIS that's actually achievable, measurable and timely and all of that stuff, and relevant and possible.
Right, and maybe we can make specific recommendations about WHOIS that would require this larger question to be addressed or examined. Okay, and we can back the powers that be into that corner, but I don't know that we can take that one on head on. So.
Susan, Peter, and then I saw various other hands. Michael, Bill.
So I just wanted to comment on your comment, Bill, where you used the example of PayPal, and Facebook has the same resources, and we provide a full-blown case developed to law enforcement. In the same way, I think we can look at ICANN in that same way, that we need to, our responsibility is to provide all of that, because ICANN is never going to have the resources or be able to have that knowledge base and have the sort of drive to do that. And so I think, even though I think we could, there's some recommendations here that we would request that ICANN look at, do periodic reviews of registrars, I'm not sure that that's something they would have the bandwidth for, but maybe we should recommend, to me we should make a long recommendation list and then sort of weed them out. So
I've got Peter, Michael, Bill.
I've got two comments that I've been accumulating. So the first one is to the discussion between Kim and Lynn. I'm not sure I'm right here, but I might be, like, I'd like to add something. The distinction between bad actors, between registrants and registrars. One thing I've heard from discussions within the community is that some registrants have, potentially bad actor registrants have large portfolios of names, and it's actually cheaper for them to get those names to become accredited as a registrar and buy the names in bulk. I've heard rumours that people are simply being registrars to get large portfolios of names for themselves. So I think that distinction may be blurry. I'm not sure if that's 100% correct, but that's something I've certainly heard. The other comment I was going to make, I think James has covered off, I think this is definitely an area we should be looking at if we're tasked at looking at how effective ICANN is in enforcing its policy. And the implementation. Then, if we've got a problem here that, in terms of its ability to regulate, its ability to enforce, I think we need to go there. And I think James has hit on the way that we can do that. Maybe we can't tackle this big problem head on, but we can craft our recommendations in such a way that it becomes important that it is dealt with to get there. So I think it's, I can't imagine we can shy away from this.
Michael?
I am very pleased that my modest input was so highly appreciated. I repeat again, it was my question. So my main issue was to understand whether it is an issue. Of course, as it was clear from the discussion, it mostly may be an issue of accountability. For me, the question is, I would just put an example. If we learn that there is some irregularity in terms of compliance as for a certain registrar, there is a clear understanding where within ICANN we should go and who will take which action. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that such understanding exists as for the violation of WHOIS policy. And to my mind, if it is like that, it's better to give a recommendation to create such kind of policy or understanding. But and it goes to the part 12. But if we are now sitting in the part 11, we should define it as a gap. I do not insist to say that the problem is that there is no regulator as such, but we should indicate that the gap exists, and it is like that. That's all. Thank you.
I was going to suggest that we just pop no regulator into inverted commas, because it's now become a kind of code that we understand. Yeah. We don't really mean that there's no regulator. It's the issues that follow from it about authority, accountability, support, a sense of partnership in a compliance, I think was the point that you were raising. Bill?
Sure, and I too thank Michael for the brevity of his interjection and initial interjection and the conversation that it spawned. It has been a very, I found it to be one of our more interesting conversations, and I especially like the putting in quotes the regulator. I think what we're looking for is in essence the effect of a regulator, right? I think we're seeing, I certainly am, significant gaps in terms of what a regulatory authority might provide in the current implementation. And to Susan's point on private action, I absolutely agree that we, the private actors, can do more to help ICANN. I think we may need to look at some contractual things that would enable us to provide more information. But there has to be then people who are accountable and will take action if we provide information. I know that we have some difficulties, and I'm pretty sure all of the private actors do in sharing information at times. We PayPal think this is a pretty significant issue that needs to be addressed internationally, and then sort of locally, basically where it's okay to share certain pieces of information, not necessarily sensitive, personally identifiable information, but pieces of information that will help track down criminal elements where we're dealing with cybercrime or cybersecurity in particular. Not to breach data privacy laws, but basically there are some gray areas that we certainly see when we go and attempt to do some of this stuff with partners. There's pushback. Certainly in the U.S. with some U.S. regulations, laws and regulations, and we think some of that would be great if that were cleared up. But there is a way to do that through contractual arrangements currently.
Right. I think we've done a good job on gaps on policy. I'd like to move on to gaps on compliance. But first of all, I want to just think about our timekeeping this afternoon. We're going to be finishing at 5. The implementation sub-team have then got a meeting with the compliance people, and obviously anybody who's interested is welcome to join that. One of our priorities for this meeting, before we go on to our stakeholder meetings, is to understand why we're doing what we're doing. So I want to give a good hour to that before the end of the day. So 4 o'clock, whatever we're doing, we're going to start on that, all right? Which is now 2:15. We've got various things that we said we've wanted to do, and we're going to have to do some triage here. Okay, we want to get through to the end of this document. We want to do some brainstorming on stakeholders, and we also want to hear the presentation, see the presentation from the implementation sub-team. Can I get a sense of how we're going to fit that into an hour and 3/4 from people? Or do you want some direction from me? James?
Well, just a thought here that the brainstorming on stakeholders and the stakeholder section and the merging of the definitions and the use cases into that new section was born this morning on this table. So maybe that one can cook a little bit longer on the mailing list and allow folks to brainstorm a little bit. I don't know that we're going to do it justice if we move right into just my thought. That one can go, I guess. That one can be deferred.
Yeah. Sharon?
I'd agree with that. Just on the part we've been dealing with law enforcement, it is half-cooked, you know, so whatever we present to you would be half the story at best. I'd very much like to see the presentation. See that work.
Anyone else? Anything? Anyone else for anyone else? Can I suggest that we stick with this until 3, okay? Because I think that we've still got some gaps, particularly on implementation, to highlight. Now, it may make sense to go to the implementation presentation now and come back to this. I don't care.
Just a quick question to those who... I'm on the implementation sub-team, and just a quick question to the others on the implementation sub-team. Have we got a presentation? Excellent. Thank you. Yep.
You didn't see it, Peter?
Hey.
I'm sure you did, yes.
I really am very, very happy.
Yes, yes.
I'd be quite, for what it's worth, quite keen to continue on this just for a little while, because I think if we move on to the next gap, if we stick with this just for a little while longer, we identify a few more gaps, I feel like personally I could, when I get home and I get a chance to do the things that we promised before here, like start drafting some text, I'll know where to go. Yeah.
Okay, can I suggest that we have a 5-minute comfort break, come back, do the rest of this till 3, think about finishing this at 3 in all of our interventions. We're going to finish our gap analysis and have a first stab at what recommendations. Then we'll go to the implementation presentation at 3, and then at 4 we do our what's happening this week. Yeah.